Week in Retronauts, a journey into anal retention. Everyone, and welcome to Retronauts, your official podcast for old things. Actually, are we official? Have we ever really like petitioned for official status?
Do we need to fight like retrogaming.tv or whatever?
Retroware,
sorry, man.
Maybe.
I'm slandering our competition by
like we could do the whole like battle with the Gorn in the pit of death. The dun, 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 dun.
I'd be afraid that other people are working much harder than us. So I'm going to bow out of this contest.
That wouldn't be good. Anyway, I think my name is Jeremy Parrish. I don't think I mentioned that before. And I'm hosting this episode. And with us here in the studio, well, there's Bob over there. You know that guy.
Hi, everybody. It's me.
But we've also brought in a returning guest, our good friend, Dr. Sparkle.
Yep, I'm back, I guess, for the third episode, I think.
Oh, that's right.
You did the prog rock.
That's right.
The most divisive episode of Retronauts in history.
Now, in this case, since there will be no prog rock mentioned whatsoever, I'm sure the fans will have no reason to complain.
Oh, don't worry. I always throw in a reference or two.
I want to point out
find an excuse.
I want to point out we know Dr. Sparkle's true name, and because of that, he has to grant us a wish.
We did summon him with the pentagram.
So I want stadium events in its packaging originally and untouched mint condition.
You know, that thing just sold for a lot less money than people thought it was going to.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because it was up to 100,000. Probably
wasn't that just
days.
I was going to say troll bids.
But I mean, in the past, boxes of that in that same condition have sold for more money than it sold. I think it was 30,000 or something.
Gosh, boy, I sure would hate to sell a video game for $30,000. I would settle for anything less than 50.
Those poor bastards.
So anyway, we have summoned Dr. Sparkle here into the studio with us for the very specific episode that touches on his expertise. Dr. Sparkle, of course, is the host of the sole creator and proprietor of Crontendo, the well-loved Nintendo history video feature.
Well-loved by whom?
By the internet. Have you not seen the forum threads praising your name to the heavens?
They say I'm a freak.
They don't like the way you say Tose, which is understandable.
Oh, but. Well, at this point, I just do it just for
But yeah, people love your show. It's great. It's been an inspiration to a lot of people, including myself. And this is another of our Kickstarter backer requests. We're still kind of clearing the channel of those. Just a couple left now. This one comes from backer Sean Clements. And he wants us to talk about cron gaming, not just Crontendo, but gaming gaming through a console's library in chronological order. I would say Crontendo is definitely the best known of this phenomenon, but it's something that's certainly spread. And I know you, in turn, were influenced by what did get you your start. Actually, why don't we start from the beginning here? First, tell us what Crontendo is. What madness besieged you?
Well, Crontendo is, generally speaking, a very bad idea. But what involves is simply playing...
but most fun things are.
Well, that's true, yes. But what it actually involves is simply playing through or playing briefly every single game in the Nintendo Entertainment System and Famicom library in chronological order of their original release.
Right, and I think that's the important distinction to make, is that it's NES and Famicom. So it's American and Japanese releases. And you're playing based in the order in which they were originally released in any territory. So if a game was released in Japan first, you go with the Japanese date. If it was released in the US or the UK first, in very rare instances, then you play it according to that date.
Yeah, as far as I can figure out. I mean, Nintendo, for whatever reason, there are no specific release dates for most US NES games. And again, with European NES games, it's pretty much anybody's guess as to when some of those things actually came out.
Yeah, it's usually it came out in this year.
But for some reason, with the Japanese titles, I mean, somehow someone kept track of the exact date and the original sticker price of every single one of those.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, the original date is, maybe not with games always, but definitely with CDs, the original release date is actually printed on the label sometimes.
Hmm.
But Japan has just been really precise about release dates with pretty much everything that I can tell. But I think, you know, it helps that the distribution system there was very compact. I mean, it's like you send stuff to Tokyo, Kyoto, and then, you know, whatever is left over, you send to the outlying provinces of, you know, like the remaining 10% of the country's population. America, of course, has a much different distribution system. And in the 80s, particularly in the early 90s, video games were still kind of regarded as toys. And I don't think you had a lot of official release dates. I think, you know, Mortal Monday was kind of like where you started
or
to see
Sonic,
that.
Sonic Tuesday.
Oh, so, yeah, I so think, it was all about Sega.
I think that was touted as the first worldwide launch of a single game, at least according to the Sega people.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, because the country does have a much broader distribution system and things were being shipped out as toys, not as electronics with, you know, with street dates on them, I think, you know, record keeping is basically just like this was the month that it was distributed and it would kind of pop up at stores anytime. And that was certainly the case in my experience when I was looking for video games, NES games at the time, was that you knew kind of when they were going to come out, but it was basically like I had an aunt who worked at Best Products in the warehouse. So she was my inside connection. Like she would get stuff fresh off the truck for me and then give me the employee discount. So it was awesome. But Best didn't really receive stuff as quickly necessarily as, say, Toys R Us, because it was, you know, a bigger department store. So they didn't prioritize necessarily the toys and electronics. It was just, you know, like stuff would come when it came. So her shipments were always a little later than Toys R Us got things, or KB Toys. So those were where you went to get the hot releases, the moment that they came out.
That was sort of like your equivalent of the uncle who worked at Nintendo.
Yes, but it was the aunt who worked at Best. It's not quite as fantastic a story, but it definitely saved me a lot of money through the years.
I would call that collusion.
Yes.
In a good way.
I mentioned in the Super Mario World episode, which may or may not have been released by the time this comes out, that the first thing I bought with my first paycheck from my first job, the first check I ever wrote, in fact, was a Super NES. My first summer job, I should say. That was actually something she picked up for me, and it was like 40% off because of her various employee discounts. So that was great. I'd forgot about that little detail, but yes. Anyway, so that's kind of a sidebar to the sort of specific date searching. And, you know, in the past year, I started doing the same thing with Game Boy because it's kind of a forgotten corner of video games. And I found the exact same experience. Like with Japanese launch dates, it's day and date specific. With American dates, it's month usually. And with European dates, it's just like sometime that year. No one really knows.
Exactly. And Nintendo had an official release of all the American official U.S. NES titles, not counting stuff from Tengen. And basically, they give a month and a year as the official release date. But again, who knows when those things were actually in the stores.
So how do you solve that problem?
Well, basically, I just sort of tend to lump 1 month's worth of any of American games into like a little chunk. Mm-hmm. You know, stick them in somewhere in that month in terms of the Japanese games. I figured 1 month is close enough. You know?
Right. Yeah, I just put it on the 15th of each month, usually.
All right.
Like, in the middle. So that's the closest you can be to being accurate without knowing.
Exactly. Well, you do one game per episode.
Yeah, we can talk more about that. But
whereas I do 15, so I sort of have to, like, I kind of want to sort of, like, stick, like, five in one episode.
Oh, I didn't realize it was 15 per episode. Is that your hard and fast rule?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I've actually never violated
them. Oh.
You know, that's why some episodes are short and some are long.
Okay, I've seen them all multiple times. I never picked up on that fact.
Wow.
Weird. I'm a bad viewer. I'm a bad fan.
Or just not particularly into math.
I hate math.
There you go.
I'm against it.
Even counting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I picked the buy game approach after watching sort of the toll that doing big lumps has taken on your sanity. The
psychological toll.
It's
yes.
I mean, you can tell just by watching. Like you'll come into sections where it's just like this slog of terrible games, and you're like, oh god.
And you two might not know this by looking at me, but I'm actually 25 years old. I mean, honestly,
video games have ruined my life.
It all started when I started Crontendo. That's when I went downhill. But yeah, so I think the whole, you want to talk about where the whole chrono gaming concept actually started?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So here's as far as I can tell the history of chrono gaming. Back in 2005, there was this guy on the Atari Age forums who, for some reason, went on eBay and bought an Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently got the idea to simply play through every console video game released in chronological order, because he was, you know, buying the games off eBay. And I guess he figured, why not do something with this ridiculous money you're spending on these horrible old games? And the Odyssey, as you might recall, was the system where you had, like, the plastic overlay that went onto your TV screen.
Yeah, right.
There were no, like, the graphics were just dots. You control dots, and you put, like a maze or something on top of the TV screen. So that would sort of create the game. And he started doing these blog posts on the Atari Age forums, and he under the name Chrono Gamer. And apparently Chrono Gaming was the sort of word that he came up with.
Oh, so it's chrono gaming.
Not cron gaming.
We were pitched the episode topic as cron gaming. I apologize.
Well, he called himself chrono gamer, and I call it chrono gaming, but...
Well, it's not chronotendo, it's crontendo.
Well, you know, chronotendo would sound a little silly.
That O makes all the difference.
Yeah, it does.
Right. So, yeah, and he actually did a post on that, I mean, almost every day for... couple years, he got through the Odyssey, the Fairchild, a good chunk of the 2600. Then he just kind of, I guess, burnt out.
And no. and how would that happen?
And one thing he did was, I mean, these would be like little write-ups, you know, in the forums. But occasionally he would create like a very short video, just kind of saying, I know this is kind of hard to describe what this game looks like, so I created this, you know, 20-second clip of me playing it, you know, filmed with like a camera pointed towards the TV set. And to me, that seemed like a very helpful idea to sort of, you know, visualize what a game actually looks like. Sometime in the middle of 2005, another guy, there was an online gaming magazine called Retro Times Monthly, Retro Gaming Times Monthly.
Hmm.
It actually hasn't done anything in a few months, I think. But there was one guy called Scott Jacoby who sort of started doing a monthly column called NES Domain, I think.
Hmm.
And he was basically just playing the Nintendo games, Japanese and American, in chronological order and writing about like five of them.
Hmm.
So those were the first two people who sort of came up with a concept, and that, of course, is where I heard about it.
Oh, wow. For some reason, I'm thinking that like Hardcore Gaming 101 started as a attempt to write up every NES game. Am I remembering
Hardcore
this?
Hardcore Gaming 101 actually evolved from the, what was it called, Classic Game Preservation Society,
okay,
or something like that. And it was really like a bunch of reviews that Kurt Kalata did of old games, Genesis, NES, some Super NES. And he would, you know, like give them scores based
okay
on graphics and sound. And there were like these funny little bars at the bottom. And then that kind of turned into, I guess, a collection of bigger things. And then that turned into more like a, you know, here's the lowdown
okay
on every system you can imagine under the sun that maybe people don't write about very often.
I wasn't sure if he was trying to be comprehensive with that or not.
I don't think so. I think they focus mostly on, largely on stuff that's not as common or popular. So you might have noticed there's no like Mario article there, which is kind of a weird oversight. You think that like, you know, that's kind of a basic thing, but I think they want to focus on stuff that's less popular.
Yeah, there's tons
of that. That was the original concept, but I think now they're sort of running out of obscure games, so now they're doing like Mega Man and stuff like that, or, you know, slightly more well-known stuff.
Right.
So, basically, the Chrono Gamer guy, you know, did it for a while, eventually burnt out. Scott Jacoby did it for a while, moved on to something else. There was another blog that did maybe for a few months, kind of did the same thing. Again, just little write-ups. And people will somehow, you know, where these guys failed, I will somehow succeed. Don't know why I thought that. But.
Well, you've gotten pretty far.
Yeah.
The Famicom launched in 1983, July 1983, and you're up to 89?
I'm 90? Working on October 89 right now.
Wow.
So that's more than 6 years worth of video games. And the Famicom did not have a small library. It was 1,440-something games, and then whatever else was released specifically for the NES in the West and not in Japan.
Yeah, I think it's close to 1,900, 1,800 games altogether. I think I've done, 750 games so far? Close to halfway through, I suppose.
It's a lot of games.
Too many. And at least half of those are just complete and utter crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, especially the early Famicom days, it was the Wild West. We talked about that in a previous episode in this recording session, but that was a period where a lot of people were like trying to figure out how video games worked and what they should be and how do you program for a video game system.
Well, that's true, but in the early days of the Famicom, I think a lot of the publishers actually were video game companies putting these things out. Nintendo put a lot of stuff out, and you got people like Konami coming in pretty early, Capcom. After a couple of years, other companies started coming in, like Pony Canyon, the record company, book publishing companies, and they were in it purely for the money. And, you know, guys like Bandai, and some of those games that were made were just, you know, so terrible because they only existed just to get a product on the shelf and hopefully make a little bit of money. They really had no stakes in making a good game the way, say, Konami would.
Yeah, how many of those were contracted out to just random development houses, too?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, guys like Pony Canyon did not have a video game development
department.
Yeah, so that's where Tosei comes in.
Exactly. So Capcom brought in Micronix, which is an even worse developer than Tosei.
That was just like one guy.
Jim Micronix.
It seems that way sometimes. And they did like 1941 42 Ghosts and Goblins.
That's kind of an interesting little footnote in Capcom's history is the point at which they started taking console development seriously, which I think was around the time of Section Z. Instead of having, you know, Micronix or some other middleware, you know, outsourced developer create a crappy version of their arcade games like they did for Commando in 1942, they were like, maybe we should just bring this in-house and make it ourselves. And they started to reinvent their games and, you know, really began to master the ins and outs of the NES so that within a few years, they were making some of the best games on the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of that's part of the appeal of this cron gaming concept is looking back and really seeing how games evolved, not just on a platform, but within a specific company or what the discipline and the philosophy behind the development of the games is.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think probably in Capcom's early days, they weren't really sure how the whole Famicom thing was going to pan out. I mean, would there be a lot of money in it for them? Was it worth their time? So I would assume they didn't want to devote a lot of resources into, you know, using their own internal people to kick out these quick ports.
Well, I don't think Capcom even had an internal department for a while. They started in 1983. Like, that was when the company was established, making arcade games. So initially, for those first couple of years, I think that their home conversions had to be outsourced because they didn't have the development talent. And at last year at GDC, I hosted a Keiji Inafune panel, and he was talking about how when, you know, they started doing their own console development, like the console team was kind of separate from the rest of the company and sort of like the redheaded stepchildren. And they weren't really kind of, you know, part of the inner circle at that point. So it was something that the company kind of brought in and was like, but then became the red butter.
Back to sort of the history of Krona Gaming, I started doing Krontendo in, I believe, September 2007. So I guess about 2 years after a couple other folks had done it. And I think Crontendo was sort of discovered by the internet at large around 2009.
Yeah, the first mention I heard of it was around then, and that was Frank Cifaldi.
Mm-hmm. That's how I found out about it, too.
He was a big cheerleader of it.
Mm-hmm. And there was a little website called OMG Nintendo that was one of the very first people to mention it. Sort of, you know, people were watching the episodes and, you know, making comments, but it was like maybe like 100 views per episode or something. Tiny Cartridge was another early one. Basically, it went from being something that pretty much only a handful of people were looking at. But once like OMG Nintendo and Tiny Cartridge and a few other people started talking about it, that's when suddenly people started coming into the site and looking at it.
And your videos weren't always on YouTube, right? Well, they weren't. The length requirement, right?
Right. I mean, when I started it, I mean, that was one of the concerns was I wanted to do it in video form. I didn't want to do seven-minute videos, I think, was like the length of YouTube back then, and then they kicked it to like 15.
Right,
and
yeah.
Like a few years ago, they finally knocked it up to like infinity or whatever. But, which unfortunately ended up with stuff like what, like the 10-hour looping.
Of an annoying song or like a sound effect.
Yeah, people take advantage of that. But yeah, I mean, obviously 7 minutes or 8 minutes, whatever it was, wasn't really going to be an option. So I went to archive.org, mm-hmm. which had no length limits at all. And would host pretty much anything, you know, based on the content that I saw there.
So did you have a specific methodology in mind when you first started besides 15 games per episode in chronological order?
Well, I was thinking I would have each episode be like about 45 minutes, which is what they originally were when I was doing games like Donkey Kong or Mario Brothers or something, you know. 45 minutes seems like it's long enough. People can actually watch it. Of course, unfortunately, I mean, since then, well, I don't know, maybe people like long episodes, but I've had them stretch out like, I think like an hour and 45 minutes. Thereabouts, the one with the Nintendo RPG Mother was, I think, one of the longest ones.
I was going to mention that one.
The episode of Phantasy Star 2 was, again, incredibly long. But yeah, the whole idea was, you know, 45 minutes or so, people could watch that, but yet it wasn't like, that way I would put out one like every 3 weeks or once a month or something like that. For a steady flow of content, which hasn't always worked out recently, but...
I forgive you.
Originally, I mean, those things were coming out pretty darn quick.
Yeah, they were. And I think people underestimate the amount of work that goes into producing something like this. That's certainly been my discovery. Mm-hmm. I mean, doing Game Boy World has been a learning experience for me because I basically have trained myself up from zero on doing video production, which is good. But, you know, like the process of recording footage and then editing it. And then I don't know if you write a script or if you just kind of improvise. But for me, I write a script and then record it and then edit it down. And then I have to put the video to it. Like even for, you know, a short Game Boy video that's like 5 to 7 minutes long, that's hours and hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a lot of work, and video editing takes a lot of time. I guess you don't necessarily notice the edits when you're watching it, just like you don't always, when watching a movie, think how long it took the editor to put that thing together. But yeah, you know, an hour and 50-minute video has zillions of edits.
I can see the timeline now. Just like chop.
Exactly. I posted a couple pictures of like the
oh, yeah, that's right.
When it, you know, it looks like just, you know.
Yeah, you pretty much stick to video game footage, though, just showing off the games.
Right.
You don't pull in, I mean, occasionally
I've seen
like, pull in some media, but...
Yeah, if there's, like, it's based on, like, a cartoon or something, or a comic book, I'll try to, like, show a few images of that. Of course, that seems to be getting you and people in more and more trouble nowadays on YouTube.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask about that. Have you gotten any, like, strikes against your account or anything like that in terms of using footage, not just from games?
I get content ID acknowledgments. So, but the thing is, Crontendo is not commercial, so it's they're not really going to do anything.
Right.
Yeah. But if you don't monetize your channel or your specific videos, then they don't really care. They just say like, you know, whoever owns the original content here has the right to put ads on your video if they want.
Right.
There are no strikes. That's only if you take money from YouTube.
So there is one episode that cannot be viewed in Japan.
Ooh,
because,
too hot for Japan.
As many things are. But just, it was, again, it was like 10 seconds of some anime footage that was in there.
Oh, wow.
And you can still see it. It's not blocked in the U.S. or any other country, just apparently just Japan.
Which anime was that?
I honestly don't recall. It didn't happen until, like, years after I posted the episode.
The content ID strikes or, you know, notices that I've gotten have been really kind of hit or miss. Like, I've included footage of Hollywood movies, and I don't get anything. But then I put some footage of a fan sub of Fist of the North Star in my Fist of the North Star 10 Big Brawls for King of the Universe episode. And I got a content ID notification, not from, like, the original owners of, you know, whoever Viz or whoever owns Mr. North Star, but whoever did the fan sub, like, somehow claiming copyright on Fist of the North Star videos that they dubbed, which that's interesting.
I thought it was Disney. Like, we probably own this. We don't want to look into it, but it's probably ours.
I think we own
this. Weirdly enough, like, back in the Wild West days of YouTube, back when no one cared about anything, there were no commercials. Like, I put a song by The Cars in a video, like a funny video I made, and I left it up. And, like, for years, I would get constant emails like, you're in trouble. Now you're not in trouble. Now you're in big trouble. Now you better take this. It just, like, I don't care. I'm not going to do anything. Like, I just, like, I felt like much ado about nothing for this video that I uploaded 8 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, and yeah, I think content ID has everyone kind of confused and baffled as to why certain things get singled out, and why also there's a lot of, like, sort of false hits as well. I actually put up footage, it's like a super short video of like a modern game. I think it was Sphere or something like that. And I got a content ID on a sound effect, which was like footsteps.
Weird.
Was like from some completely obscure music company, and they even put like a song title, which I could not find anything about on the internet. It was strange.
I wonder if they just like go in and get bully libraries and say, yeah, we own the rights to this. I think most of the content ID is based on audio, actually.
Yeah.
I think they have, you know, the algorithms that can compare sound effects and music and so forth, and that's what they go for. It's not the video stuff. Maybe the video is forthcoming, but I think audio is easier to do. And I think maybe the reason I haven't gotten a lot of copyright notices on my stuff is because I generally, for like Hollywood videos or something, turn the audio way down for most of it and talk over it, so you don't even necessarily see anything. Like, I put some Top Gun footage in the Malibu Beach volleyball game as kind of like a, hey, I wonder if this is why volleyball games suddenly became very popular for a little while.
All right.
but I didn't actually have the audio of Top Gun in there. I probably would have gotten a notice if I had done that.
It's like if you watch The Simpsons on YouTube, you can watch it, but it's going to be the film negative flip backwards in German in a smaller window, like while another episode is playing behind it. It's just like, we've done everything we can to fool YouTube for you to watch The Free Simpsons. Not like those costly Simpsons.
Which is what The Simpsons are worth nowadays, I suppose.
Ooh.
Wow.
Take that, Simpsons
fans.
Shots
fired.
Are there any more actual, honest to God Simpsons fans?
There has to be a few.
I mean,
but
for the modern shows, the contemporary ones.
I'm sure there are kids that grew up with it while it was bad, and they don't know that it was good. So,
like, the animation of those old episodes is stupid. That episode must be stupid.
Yeah, let's ask a child. The next child we see,
kids react to old Simpsons.
Probably already been done. Probably.
Yeah. But have they reacted while eating a chili pepper? We're going to find out. That's right. I'm taking you to task, chili pepper gaming or whatever. I don't care.
I haven't seen
That's a real thing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Playing a game while eating like a ghost pepper?
It's like review a game while eating a pepper, whatever. It's harmless, but it's just like, it's our gimmick, you know, whatever.
Play a game while doing the ice bucket challenge.
Yeah, exactly. Watch, in 2 years, we'll be eating chili peppers, dumping ice buckets on our head while we're talking.
I'm hot inside and cold out.
I'm dying.
Okay, let's see. Where were we? We were talking about stuff.
YouTube strikes.
Yes, right. YouTube. Well, before that.
Process.
It was kind of a sidetrack.
Well, eventually, of course, YouTube, you know, sort of broke their 15-minute limit, and I started putting stuff up on YouTube as well. But not all the old episodes, which causes people to constantly ask me, you know, where are the old episodes? No matter how many times I say they're on archive, eventually, of course, I'll upload them. But now each episode goes up on archive and up on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider the archive ones to be sort of like the correct
PR canon.
Because, of course, YouTube does all kinds of crazy processing to them and rendering, whereas you can technically just download the original file that I put up from archive, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should start posting my stuff on archive. I've just been using YouTube, and it does introduce a lot of degradation, which is kind of stupid because my learning process has included like working with better equipment, because I really wanted to capture Game Boy games from the original cartridge, even though emulation of Game Boy is pretty solid. Game Boy Color is a little flaky sometimes still, but I just wanted to work with like, the original cartridges on as close to authentic hardware as I could. So I started with like a portable Super Famicom clone running a Super Game Boy, which was pretty good. Like I was impressed with myself that I managed to kind of put together this contraption that actually worked. But I noticed right away with Super Mario Land that as it was scrolling to the side, there was like this really terrible graphic flaw at the top. And it wasn't anything to do with the game itself or even the emulation, but just the fact that the device I was using was only outputting through composite video, which is terrible. But it seemed okay. But then once you introduced that and then put the YouTube compression on it, like my source video looked okay, but then the YouTube version was just like distractingly garish. If you go back, I haven't fixed it yet, so that video is kind of hard to watch because of the graphical distortion. And a guy who works with Twitch, who has been, you know, kind of following the video project, was like, hey, you know, I have some better video equipment. I'd be happy to donate it to the cause, which was very nice of him.
Wow. Wow.
So I went and tracked down an RGB modded Super NES, and then he provided an upscaler, a NEX RGB Mini FrameMeister. It was very, very generous of him, and I'm deeply appreciative for it. But just the difference in quality between the video output and the audio output, I did a sample comparison as a quick little video people can watch, and like the music is better, the video is better, it's just cleaner. But you know, going onto YouTube, there is a lot of compression introduced, so still doesn't look as good as it should. So I should probably look into the archive.org thing.
I do want to ask Dr. Sparkle, like, how do you record? How do you capture footage? Like, what do you source it from?
Everything is done basically just using an emulator.
Okay.
A lot of the earlier people who were doing it were actually some chrono gamers. Actually get the hardware in the games. Obviously, there's no way I'm even going to consider trying to track.
You don't want to own 1900 NES and Famicom games?
I've already, obviously, just the expense, the difficulty in sort of getting stuff, you know, from a Nintendo into some kind of captured video footage. You know, just using emulators. For NES, it's pretty good 99.9% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few games that will have problems, but
I'm not really a stickler. I'm just curious because I do a lot of emulating, and I just, for the sake of being practical, you know.
I use an emulator that actually just outputs it to, I think, 518 by 480. It's like an AVI file.
Mm-hmm.
From there.
Yeah, I've personally never really liked emulation. I mean, I think it's neat that you can do it, and I've always, you know, like especially when it first started out, I was really fascinated by it. But I just don't like playing on emulators. It just doesn't feel right to me. And that's probably just me being snotty, but it's not really intended that way. I'm not like, I don't look down on people who play with emulators. I don't like it. And I thought, you know, maybe it would be fun to do my project authentically as possible. I don't think I'm going to buy, say, Trip World or Amazing Tater because those cost like $1,000 each. Oh, thanks.
That's admirable.
I've so far, everything I've captured has been from the original ROMs and, you know, now using original hardware. I even managed to get a hold of, thanks to another donation, a Super Game Boy 2, which is different than a Super Game Boy. It was only released in Japan. And makes some small hardware corrections so that it runs at the actual speed of a Game Boy. The Super Game Boy is like 3% too fast. So it's pretty not noticeable. Like, I haven't really seen a difference, but I had people constantly commenting, like, you really ought to get a Super Game Boy too. So I did. And so now it has a different border. That's basically the only impact I can tell. But the music is pitched differently, apparently.
Weird. I didn't know that.
Well, nowadays, I mean, it's actually tough to play games from an actual NES because you have to have the right kind of monitor or TV screen to do it. And trying to put it just like on your regular big flat screen like everyone has just looks, you know, horrible, obviously.
It can, yeah.
Yeah, I want to do more than just Game Boy, not necessarily a Chrome gaming project or everything, but just more classic video game content. So I have foolishly ordered one of those analog NTs, which does HDMI video out with RGB. So that'll run through the FrameMeister. And I hope to put together some really nice, you know, crisp, like real hardware, real software NES videos.
Whenever I hear FrameMeister, I can't help but think that he was like a guy who got cut out of Rudolph on the Island of the Toys.
I'm the FrameMeister. But I don't know what his problem is, but just imagine
he was
him
framed.
He has no alibi.
Okay, so what were we talking about again?
Sourcing and, you know, like ROMs and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Obviously, and part of the, I think, the appeal of the whole Chrono Gaming thing was, I mean, and when we were young, of course, I mean, we got our hands on what video games we could, only a tiny fraction of things that came out. And then at some point, you know, every single retro game that's ever been released suddenly became readily available to anyone who wanted to play it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you look at these games, I mean, it's just like this, just these huge, you know, zip files of all these ROMs and whatnot. And I guess we thought it would be interesting to sort of go through them and actually see what was in there. Especially because, I mean, one particular title, and I've mentioned before, that always, one particular title that always sort of struck out on me was the Jesus Bio Monster.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because when you see
it's
that, like,
dreadful Bio Monster.
Dreadful Bio Monster. And we see that in a ROM list, you go, oh my God, what could that game be? I mean, what kind of strange things are hidden, you know, in these massive collections of 1,700 ROMs.
That's how I got my education. Just when emulation broke, I was just like, I must play everything. Oh my God, this had a sequel. This is actually a different game in Japan. Like, just like learning about so much stuff that was previously unavailable to me just because I'm a dumb American kid. So, yeah, like, it really opened my eyes.
Like with Black Bass, for example, the fishing game, we actually got Black Bass 2 in the U.S. In Japan, they had an earlier Black Bass 1, which was even stupider. I mean, Black Bass 2 is actually an improvement over the original.
It's still awful.
Still awful, but an improvement.
Yeah.
We actually, I think a few things kind of, we got like the slightly better version in the U.S., like the later version. We never saw some of the really horrible stuff that came out in Japan. Like Fist of the North Star.
Right.
Yes, there were several of those.
We got the good one?
Question
mark? Okay.
Actually, there were later ones that went like all RPG. Have you played any of those yet?
Not yet.
I had a crash course in Fist of the North Star games when I did the Game Boy one. And man, that series, not a lot of good, actually no good games, but they sure tried. Like, yeah, they tried to do the RPG thing later on.
I
but
think
it's still an action game.
I think Dr. Sparkle is going to be playing a lot of Dragon Ball games very soon.
Yeah, I've done two.
Oh, okay.
Including one that was actually released in the U.S.
Dragon Power, is that
exactly,
it? Yeah.
Yes, they sort of took out all the references to Dragon Ball.
And panties.
Very poorly, I might add. That sandwich looks like a pair of panties to me, no matter which way you slice it.
You know, like the Triangle Club sandwiches.
Lunch has changed forever.
Once I knew what it was, I couldn't look at that sandwich again.
Couldn't unsee it, as they say. Yeah, it sort of wanted to actually sort of see what was in these huge collections. And sort of, I mean, I guess my mind kind of has a desire to sort of like organize and sort things. So I thought it would be instructive just to see, you know, sort of go through a thing and see actually what was there. Were there hidden gems? What kind of trash was out there?
Mm-hmm.
A lot. And doing it, I mean, you sort of see patterns. You see how it's like games sort of slowly got better. You see companies sort of emerge, put out games,
yeah,
and disappear forever.
I do see you trace fads throughout your videos. Like, this is the evolution of the Japanese adventure game. It started with Portopia, and it's going to be a lot of these worst things. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not, but this is where it started, and this is how it's moving.
Sports games, Dragon Quest clones.
Dragon Quest clones, yes.
Yeah.
Or Dragon Quest-inspired games.
Mm.
And every company put one out. I mean, Hudson did one. Well, of course, recently I covered Mother, which was...
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo's very belated entry into the whole RPG thing. They really waited that one out compared to most other companies.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess they wanted theirs to be special.
Or they're just a very conservative company.
Yeah.
They don't like to take other people's ideas. They like to do their own ideas. One of the weird things about Nintendo.
Yeah, they would never make a video game based on a popular Hollywood movie involving a giant ape.
hey, that was legally, that was a different ape. Completely different in every way, and shape, or form.
That was supposed to be a Popeye game originally.
That's right, yeah, game. Yeah.
And of course, they did a real Popeye game.
Which was not nearly as good as Donkey Kong.
No.
So I guess we dodged a bullet. My question to you is, where does the compulsion to do these cron gaming things come from?
You know, I've never spoken to my psychiatrist about that. I don't know. It's
well, I'm not just speaking about you. Like, it's something a lot of people do, myself included. Like, I don't know if it's a sickness or if it's just like people who like video games. There's a certain segment of us who are just like
crap, really. I mean, it's like people who collect comic books. I mean, they have to get every issue. It's the same.
Right, the this kind of completism, but also the need to catalog things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just video games. Like, music bands are the same way.
God, people with records, yeah. I mean, they're always reorganizing their record collections. It's just, you know, we live in a society where we don't have to work in the fields 10 hours. And
so,
we need something to occupy ourselves with.
I mean, I'm not, I don't make video, but whenever I do an episode about a series with a lot of games, I take a very cron gaming perspective where I usually take them one at a time, talk a little bit about them. Some people don't like it, some people do, but I feel that's a really good approach when you're talking about a series with like a dozen games in it, you know? And it comes from that need that I have to compartmentalize and organize things and just make neat little piles and then distribute them throughout the world via audio, I guess.
And also, yeah, again, sort of doing things in order allows you to sort of see how things develop over time.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that the existence of things like Crontendo and just the pervasiveness of this approach is, and you know, even just like lists at Wikia or something like that, has really changed my approach to how I do retrospective content for my day job at US Gamer. I don't, you know, back at 1UP we did a lot of like, here's a chronology of the series or, you know, that kind of thing, but like there's no value in that unless you go into extraordinary depth, like with Crontendo or something. Like just doing an overview, that stuff exists out there already. I guess you can get some easy traffic if you're lucky with SEO, but like what's the point of it unless you're just, you know, trying to get some ad impressions?
Yeah, there were, as some of you guys might know, there's like sort of that genre of YouTube video where it's like, you know, 20 seconds of every video game or something.
Like, yeah.
That. Like just like the opening sequence of every video game, you know, 300 NES games, you know, and like acting some kind of video. And I sort of wanted to do something that was a lot different than that, which is actually sort of look at these things, play through them a bit, analyze them, and sort of see how they fit in with the rest of what was going on in gaming at that time.
It's funny, like when you make YouTube videos professionally or whatever, it's like you need to get their eye in 8 seconds or you lost them. And now it's like YouTube is for old people. They're all about the vines now. So I think it's like you don't really need to worry about making YouTubes too long because apparently even YouTube is played out for the kids, you know, just like.
I have not transitioned the content over to Vine
yet. Where's your micro content?
I am on Twitter now.
Oh, yeah.
Tumblr. And Tumblr.
Your Tumblr feed is like this tease. Like, you'll just suddenly dump a bunch of title screens. And I'm like, oh, there must be a new episode coming. Yeah, and then maybe like 4 months later.
In theory, I'm sort of on Tumblr sort of trying to create kind of like a, you know, constant little bits here and there of what's going to be coming out on the new episode. But it's hard to manage like the blog, the videos, Twitter, the Tumblr.
Yeah.
And of course, pretty soon I'll have to be on Pinterest. Tinder. What's Tinder again? Is that one of dating?
Yeah, dating.
Cron dating.
Cron dating. You can talk about all your girlfriends in order.
I really need to grow my brand.
Absolutely. You are a media influencer.
In that case, you should be like, I'm the PO'd chronologist, and I'm going to show you these NES games I hate.
The angry video game chronologist.
Yeah, just you need a gimmick like that.
Based chronologist.
Or eat hot peppers while you narrate. Come on. We can combine them.
And actually, you know, you mentioned one thing, which of course is that when I started doing Crontendo, kind of the tone was going to be different than what I saw in a lot of other video game videos. I think the Angry Video Game Nerd got famous around, what, 2006?
Right after YouTube took off.
Yeah, has it been that long?
Yep. And for the record, I'm not slandering him. I just feel like too many people have that gimmick. Like,
well, yeah. After he did it, suddenly there was like the mad video game nerd. Yeah.
I'm angry too.
Pissed off.
Yeah.
I'm angry in a slightly different way.
The happy video game nerd. But I mean, yeah, there was definitely that sort of style where you were talking about games, you were showing games, you're also making a lot of poop jokes.
Yeah.
And I really wanted Quantum to be more or less, you know.
Okay, but you've made some poop jokes on Crontendo.
Almost always scatological free, you know. No scatological.
I think they're usually limited to the poop jokes in the games themselves, right?
If they're like JJ and Jeff, where the birds actually drop like dog
perfectly. Yeah,
you haven't done Toilet Kid yet, have you?
Not yet. No. Looking forward to that.
I challenge you to make it through Toilet Kids without making poop jokes.
But I want to be the kind of guy who is not like screaming, yelling, because I mean. When you play a bad game, it's not really that awful to be playing a bad video game. I mean, it's not going to give you a heart attack or cause you to need to yell and scream a lot. So I sort of took a more even-handed approach to the game. Even really terrible ones like the 900 baseball and golf games.
Yeah, I think when you have that sort of like everything makes me angry approach, after a while you get through the stuff that's really bad, and then you're just kind of like straining to find excuses and. I'm not the sort of hyperbolic kind of screechy rage monster anyway. So,
well, perhaps you should look into that.
Should I?
Well, for PewDiePie, right?
Isn't
he upset all the time about something?
I don't think it's upset. I think it's just a kind of a mania that overtakes him.
He's only making $3 million a year before.
I was like playing like horror games and got like scared or something.
Yeah, he like freaks out at horror.
I cannot watch more than 5 seconds of his stuff. But.
That's okay, because that's a video impression, so that's funny. That's all he needs from you, really.
You made a powerful Finnish enemy today. And it's not me.
my apologies for missing other video game people. You can edit that out.
I understand it's not for me. Most of the people I know that watch his videos are like little kids, and I forget that little kids also use the internet, so there's nothing wrong with entertaining children.
My nephew, I mentioned once PewDiePie to him, and he's like, what's wrong with PewDiePie? Well, maybe someday you'll find out. But yeah, he's like, well.
Yeah.
And to him, I mean, that's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm the same way. I have a bunch of nephews and second cousins, and I'm around them all the time, and they love that stuff on YouTube. Like, they are more likely to watch videos of someone playing Sonic or making, like, bad Sonic animations than actually playing Sonic. Like, I don't know that they've ever actually played Sonic. They know him from Smash Brothers, and they know him from videos that they've watched, but they don't actually own any Sonic games.
Yeah, at some point, I mean, we will not actually have to play games ourselves. We'll simply watch other people playing them. That's sort of what's happening in a lot of ways. I mean, there's games.
I mean, that's what Rise: Son of Rome is all about.
Yeah.
Watch the gameplay itself.
I mean, I would never play an Assassin's Creed game because I don't have the time. Not that they're bad games. I've seen people play them on Twitch, and it looks interesting. But
well, the great thing about Assassin's Creed is it's just a big checklist for you to go through, so you don't have to worry about like getting lost or figuring out things to do on your own. Just follow the checklist. It's great.
Personally, I use Let's Plays and videos like yours to go through like survival horror games I know will be too annoying for me to play through. So most of my survival horror experience is through Let's Plays and YouTube people just like playing through it. Not the kind that like scream when they're scared, just the kind of like, here's what I'm doing now, here's what's happening now. Like, you know, just very measured and explanatory.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of good Let's Plays out there. I think those started becoming a thing like about, 2006.
The Something Awful forum probably had a lot to do with that. I mean, I know they existed outside of that, but I think that's where the groundswell happened. Everyone was like, oh, this is what a Let's Play is. Let's do these. And then YouTube happened. And it's like, oh, we can make videos out of these now. So yeah, I started looking into that maybe around 2006, 2005. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I started seeing stuff like that myself. And that's when I decided, okay, this project has to be in the form of videos and there's really no other way to cover these games, because who's going to want to read about 1,700 games without ever sort of seeing what they look like?
And I think that's the right approach to take. I actually started up something called NES ABC probably like 6 or 7 years ago on my blog. The idea was to go through the entire NES catalog in alphabetical order and write like funny blurbs about it and draw an illustration about each game. And after about 5 or 6 games, I realized this isn't really doing it. Like, I'm kind of relying on people knowing what these games are, and I let it taper off. And you know, I thought it would be a fun project, but I wanted to do it a more effective way. And you know, watching Crontendo made me say, "Oh, That's a much smarter way to go about it, which is, you know, how what eventually sort of mutated into Game Boy World.
And as far as I can tell, in Japan, like, I think about, like, 1% of the population has done that at some point. When you start looking for things like Japanese games, you'll see, like, all these sites that are, like, devoted to, like, sort of listing and talking about every single Famicom game. And there's a few people who have done it in the U.S. as well. I know there's at least one guy whose name escapes me who has actually written up every single U.S. NES release.
That's Dylan Cornelius.
Oh, right, right.
Questicle.
Questicle.
Okay. Quest review every NES game. And now he's working on Sega, doing the entire Sega home console catalog, starting with the SG-1000.
Well, actually, yeah, there is him, but I think I was thinking of someone else. This is a guy who wrote like these really sort of academic-type write-ups of these games, which, I mean, personally was not my style. Like, I don't really want to sort of try to put, like, you know, Freudian ideas, looking for Freudian stuff, or, you know, that kind of thing in these games.
It's especially difficult when you're doing that from an American perspective, talking about Japanese developed games.
And I believe this guy actually was an academic himself. He wasn't just like...
Was it Ian Bogost?
It was not, no. But yeah, the guy's name escapes me though. So the people who have actually gone all the way through their entire projects, of course doing it in video form like you and I are doing, is going to take us a bit longer. What's your time frame for Game Boy World?
Oh, never. I'm not going to finish the entire Game Boy catalog, and... That's fine. I don't really want to. It's more something I'm doing for my own entertainment, and, you know, I do want it to be kind of a resource. I would like to get the website to a point where there is information on every single game, but I don't honestly expect within my lifetime to play every single Game Boy game one by one. And honestly, now that I've made it through the first year, the first 25 games that were released in Japan in 1989... You know, I can afford to ease off a little bit. Like, I'm going to be going through a lot of pachinko games, a lot of Gundam games, a lot of learning English games. It's okay that I don't write and record extensive videos about those. I think I'm going to be doing a lot of, like, you know, like, here's a game, here's a game, here's a game. Now here's a video about, like, five games that are all the same. Or, like, hey, let's look at every single goddamn pachinko game that comes out in the years 1990 through 1996 and just get that all out of the way at once. That's fine. It's really, like, I know my mortal limits, and that's okay. So it's really more about the exploration and discovery for me. And it's been enjoyable. Like, I've discovered a lot of games that I had never played or even heard of before already in just this initial period. Like, I didn't realize that Atlas's Quirk was a really, really fun puzzle game, but it is. And it's interesting, too, because I've discovered, you know, like you were talking about people discovering games, and you, Bob, like discovering games through other people's media work. Like when I, excuse me, when I tackled the Bugs Bunny Crazy Castle, what I discovered was that most people know that game because of the Angry Video Game Nerd.
Oh, yeah.
So the game has this really nasty reputation. Like, people think it's really terrible, but it's not. It's a pretty okay,
it's pretty simple,
arcade puzzle platformer kind of game. Not bad, not offensive in any way. It's enjoyable, especially for the time. So it's a chance for me to get a fresh perspective on things and come into the games without preconceptions. Aside from games that I already like I went into the Final Fantasy Legend knowing that I was going to say very positive things about it because I really like that series. I like Saga. I like Akitoshi Kawazu. And I don't care what you say.
Because you're a masochist.
I am. I wouldn't be working on Game Boy World if I were not a masochist. So it's natural for me to like the Final Fantasy Legend. So, yeah, I mean, so just to speak to my timeline, I'll do as much as I can for as long as I can. And, you know, I've been really fortunate. I started a Patreon just for this project, basically. And I've been able to pay for this, the materials and the equipment and everything that I'm using for it. I'm not actually making any money, pocketing any money. Like, it all goes into taxes or creating little, you know, gifts for people or the games themselves. But it does sustain itself. Like, I don't have to tell my wife, yeah, I just spent, you know, $400 or $500 on Game Boy games this month because, you know, people are into the project and they enjoy it. So, you know, as long as there's interest and as long as, you know, I'm interested, then I'll keep doing it.
So no baked beans for dinner again?
No baked beans.
Okay.
I'll never eat turnips again.
I often wonder if I actually, first of all, terms are actually pretty good if you know what to do with them.
They are, actually. There's a, up in the North Bay, up in Napa, like, the area is known for turnips, and they do some great stuff with turnips there.
I find that, God, this is so off topic, Brussels sprouts are coming back.
Beets, I guess.
Brussels sprouts are coming back, mm-hmm. and they're always sold to me as this horrific thing. It's like, were people just preparing them wrong? I don't know.
Now they shave them.
Mm. Yeah, turnips, parsnips, all that stuff, you can, like, make a pretty good stew with them. There's a lot of good things you can do with them, but sorry to go off topic there, but I often wonder if I myself will ever actually finish Grontendo. I'm sure people are probably, you know, placing bets on in their heads as to whether I'll die first or not. But I guess I feel kind of committed to try to actually finish it.
I think you've got enough momentum. I mean, if you pursue this for the next 20 years, but I don't know. Like, I'm hopeful as a viewer.
It could happen.
Yeah.
It could happen. You never know.
Do you have like a protege? Are you grooming someone to be the next Dr. Sparkle?
What happens is when they kill me.
Okay.
They then take up the burden of content.
I thought they'd have to eat your brain or something and, like, gain your knowledge.
No.
Okay. It's less disgusting than that.
It's just the curse just passes on.
Okay.
I'm actually the fourth Dr. Sparkle.
Wow.
You know, very, very early on, some podcast was talking about me many years ago, and they said it sounded like, just the tone of my voice, it sounded like I had lost a bet. which is, of course, not what actually happened, but sometimes it feels that way.
Some people are just naturally monotone in nature. Not that I would know anything about that.
That's true, yeah. You sort of have managed to capture the Dr. Sparkle sort of personality in your own videos.
It wasn't an attempt to capture anyone's personality. It's just...
Oh, yeah, you just naturally sound like that.
Ooh, I was like, rival video people.
No, it's great. I'm like, oh, there's someone else with a kind of monotone, drowsy voice doing videos. I can do this, too.
I kind of wonder if blindfolded them and, you know, played our voices back, if they'd be able to distinguish some parts sometimes when it comes to our sort of groaning video game voices.
They just have to wait till one of us says Tose.
There you go.
You guys could be the sleepy gamer, one of you. That hasn't been done yet.
The sleepy video gamer.
Welcome to Kirby's Adventure.
And I'll be the drowsy video gamer. Not a ripoff, I swear. It's my own original idea.
And of course, I've sort of teased people with the concept of, like, the Super Nintendo. Which, I mean, it's...
Has anyone done that? I know Greg Seward does, what's it called?
Generation 16. There's someone who actually just started doing Super NES games.
Yes, there is a new guy who's doing Super... And again, he's been doing it for like a month or two, so...
At this point, yes, but by the time this episode comes out...
Who knows? Right. I mean,
it may be up to the Super FX chip by then.
Many have tried and many have failed to sort of get their own chrono gaming project off the ground and going. I think people, it's something that's easy to get excited about at first, but after all, you suddenly realize, why am I doing this? I mean, that's a conversation I've had with myself many times, personally, and I'm sure you will at some point as well. But.
Well, I've already kind of reached the point where Game Boy games, I like the system, I love portable games, but I have to admit that the limitations imposed on Game Boy make it kind of difficult sometimes to really soldier through. So I'm going to augment this with some N64 games, because that's another area that's been sort of underserved.
There you go. Yeah, that was actually my exact reasoning why I never did a Kron Game Boy. Because people would always ask me, are you going to do the Game Boy? Are you going to do the Game Boy? I said no, because, I mean, visually, they're not that interesting to look at. I mean, yeah, like, there's a lot of fun games to play, but just somehow looking at, like, a half hour of, like, sort of that ugly puke green... You know, game footage from the Game Boy.
That's why you use a Super Game Boy with color palettes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Super Game Boy, yeah. But, and then, of course, you came along, so now I no longer even have to worry about doing a Game Boy since you've already...
I've seen you say, like, stop bothering me, just go look at his videos.
There you go.
Thanks, yes. I appreciate that.
So you've acquired that Sisyphean task.
Yes,
Sisyphean?
Exactly. Sure, that sissy task.
Sisyphean.
So we were kind of touching briefly on some other people who have done these projects, because we're certainly not the only ones in the world. Projects exist like this, both in text and video form. My former Ziff Davis colleague, Greg Seward, who's on the Player One podcast these days, is doing Generation 16. Bob, you mentioned that.
Yeah, I enjoy those a lot. It's a game.
He's the counterbalance to Nintendo fanaticism or Retronauts.
I mean, I get a little more. I mean, I love Dr. Sparkle's videos, but there's always something new for me there because I was never a Sega fan as a kid. So I'm discovering a lot new there just with games that are like known quantities, like Altered Beast and stuff like that. Just like, oh, I didn't know that. Okay. The Genesis music is not a good thing to fall asleep to, though. So I don't put on those videos when it's bedtime because I don't know that robot music gets into my ears.
Is he recording that from emulated games?
I don't know what he uses.
Because Genesis music is really strange. Apparently there was like a huge spread of quality in some of the capacitors they used for their sound hardware or something like that. So like there's some models that have really great rich sound. And then there are other models of the system that have just absolutely like ear shredding sound.
Yeah.
And it's not a reflection on the game. It's a reflection on the sound hardware that they build. It's really like up and down.
Well, I mean, a lot of games just have bad shrill music. Like even with Super Nintendo, without the sound chip, some games just sound farty. Like we made all these farty sounds with the sound chip because we were bad.
Oh yeah.
But
sort of like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
we're back to prog rock.
I don't know what you're talking about in terms of Emerson, Lake, and Palmer sounding like farts. But
hey, man, we call them ELP in this room.
This right? Seems more like a Einstürz und Neubauten.
But yeah, the Genesis was notoriously tinny sounding. But yeah, there's like a million different models of it, and apparently some sound better than others.
I think there are three different major sound hardware revisions in the Genesis, and you can find guides online that kind of break it down. Anyway, that's again sort of a distraction from the main topic at hand. But I haven't really spent a lot of time watching anything except Crontendo. Sorry about that, Greg. I definitely intend to watch your videos at some point. I haven't wanted to be, I guess, too heavily influenced by other ideas. It's kind of like this obnoxious pride I have about creating stuff. Anytime I create something, I don't want to look at other people's work because I'll either get really jealous and depressed that they did something better than I can do, or else I fear that I'll like subconsciously absorb their ideas and start integrating that and then, you know, be a big ripoff. Like, I mean, Game Boy World is a total ripoff of Crontendo.
Yeah, I think I saw that Greg uses like the Hobo font in his videos, and I started using that in Cronturbo, I believe.
Oh, so we have litigation happening here. You actually came here to serve Jeremy papers.
What is the Hobo font?
It's just like a ridiculous looking font. I don't know why it's called the Hobo font, but I think, as I recall, I think Greg uses it and I use it as well.
Oh, see, for Game Boy World, I use Futura, which is the closest thing you can get to the Game Boy logo because I'm a jackass graphic designer.
Is that like a proprietary font, or is that actually?
Futura, yeah, it's an ITC.
I mean, the one that Nintendo used. Does that have a name, or is it just like Nintendo's internal font?
It's probably just a slightly modified Futura.
Okay.
It's not exactly Futura, but it's really close. It could. I don't have a copy of ITC Eros, but it could be Eros. I don't think it is though. I think it's just modified Futura, which is a very like well established gothic font from the early 20th century.
That's close enough.
This is what happens when you get like three white guys in a room.
What the fuck about start talking about fonts and
that's
micro.
What really matters is fonts. Am I right, everyone?
Sorry, I learned about fonts long before I came to San Francisco, though. In my defense. So yeah, I don't know. Generation 16. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, his is definitely one of the more professionally well done projects. It's well edited. Probably a little bit more sophisticated looking than Crontendo, which is always. I mean, I haven't really changed up much in Crontendo since I started. In terms of things like the intros and the time.
Right. You still use Super NES artwork for your NES catalog exploration.
Yeah.
Eventually you'll catch up to the Super NES. You're not that far.
I guess the concept was that it's about Nintendo, not the NES specifically. But.
And you're still using some live progressive rock in your intro and outro?
I still have some Can in the outro. Yeah. At some point, I am going to come up with a new intro to Crontendo, because I sort of have, I guess, slightly upgraded intros to Cronturbo and Cronsega. And I'm trying to remember, I think me and Greg started doing the Genesis stuff about, he did his first, because I was doing Fonseca with the Master System, planning to sort of transition into the Genesis. And it's a very awkward thing. I mean, that was like, there were, what, 5-6 years where Sega was doing the Genesis, the Master System.
The Game Gear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Game Gear. The Saturn actually came in. Because the last Master System game came out shortly before the Dreamcast. You can see that.
That was just in, like, Brazil, though.
That's what I was going to say.
It was like, yeah, Brazil or Europe or something like that. But they were supporting way too many systems at one time. So the Kron Sega is like this horrible hybrid of mixing up Master System and Genesis games. And even worse than the NES, no one knows when so many of these Master System games came out in the U.S. and Europe.
But we do know one came out prior to the Dreamcast, just prior to the Dreamcast.
Prior, yes.
I do want to bring one up. I don't know if you guys have seen it. The guy's name is, Rue, I think, but his real name is Joey. He's part of the RetroWare TV guys, and I think he does this independently. It's called 16-Bit Gems, where it's not chronological, so I don't know if it's outside of the purview of this episode, but he does a lot of RPGs, like episodes about singular games that he really likes, and one episode he did was like the history of console RPGs, and I think I even wrote a one-up blog about it because it was so great, just like, let's trace console RPGs from the very beginning to today, and it was a really great episode, but again, it's not chronological, but it's very similar to what you do, like focusing in on one game at a time, not necessarily in order in his case, but it is an explanation in video form. But he has more of a presence in the videos. He like jumps out and talks to you and stuff like that.
Which, yeah, obviously in Nintendo I don't do, though I do it in the other video series that I'm working on, which probably is sort of outside the subject matter of this. But
which one is that?
That's the movie video.
The horror movies.
The Video Nasties one, okay, yeah, I'm way into that.
And I guess people were, multiple people said I look younger than I thought I was. I don't know how old I sound. I don't exactly look young, though, but people claimed I looked younger. There's a few print versions of RPG chronotype things. Mm-hmm. There's RPG Consoler.
Yeah, and that one is the guy is going through all console game, like all RPGs for consoles, but kind of reviewing them with a rubric that you would expect for PC RPGs. It's like kind of held up, you know, classic PC RPGs as the definition of what an RPG should be and saying, are these console RPGs good enough? Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a, I don't know that I agree necessarily with the central premise of the thing, but it is an interesting read.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty good. And I guess he was inspired by, I think he's mentioned me as well, but I think also mostly the CRPG guy. Mm-hmm. He was doing as many computer RPGs as he can, which is an insane task if you think about it.
I don't know his name, sorry.
It's CRPG Addict.
Okay.
He actually doesn't give out his name anywhere.
Oh, are these just text-based things?
Those are text-like blogs.
I know, I mean, he just started doing it, but Gary Butterfield's cohort, Cole Ross, is doing a blog called Hex Crank, which is a chronological exploration of survival horror. And I think he doesn't update that frequently, but it's still there's still more than a few offerings there right now.
There was someone else who was going to do a Game Boy thing before you did yours, but apparently it never got off the ground.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I don't think he ever came up with a single episode. He was talking about it. He was mentioning it to me, but apparently nothing came up with it. I guess once people realize how much work goes into it, they can easily sort of back away a bit.
Mm. I mean, part of what inspired me also was just the overwhelming sensation that in order to remain relevant in my profession, I need to crack video and be able to do video. Publishing is just leaving the print model, and now it's leaving the text model on the web. So I just feel like it's something that I needed to tackle head on, and this seemed like a fun way to do it. And I've definitely learned a lot doing Game Boy World. Like, if you look at the first couple of episodes I did, I was just kind of improvising off the cuff. The sound was terrible. The video quality was terrible. The editing was choppy and rough. And I've gotten a lot better. I'm still like learning how to use Premiere. Like every day every episode, I figure out something new I can do. But I feel like the episodes I'm doing now are a lot more sophisticated. And, you know, that's in like 7 or 8 months worth of work. So it's you know, a good opportunity to learn and grow.
Yeah, same thing with me. I mean, when I came up with the idea of Crontendo, one stumbling block was, I mean, how do you get the pictures on the computer and put them up where people can see them? There must be some kind of program to do that. I was actually at first using something terrible, I think like Nero Movie Maker or something like that, which was very, very basic video editing. Some people I know have, someone, as I recall, does it using Microsoft Movie Maker or whatever the new version of that is. And a lot of people have sort of started this and sort of fallen by the wayside. So I actually can't remember how many of them there were. There was a guy who was doing Genesis games like in text form. There was another guy who was, I've already forgotten so many of them, I'm afraid.
So many wasted lives.
Exactly, yes.
Left by the wayside.
Yes.
Thanks, Cron Gaming. It is an honorable pursuit.
Is it?
I think so.
Really?
I'm jealous. Like, I mean, I feel like it takes a certain degree of fortitude that I don't have in terms of, like, just getting burned out my own personal projects. Like, I sincerely thought about doing a Super Nintendo one because I didn't see anyone doing it. And that's, I think I have the most nostalgia for that system. But I looked at it and I was like, this, I cannot do this. It's just like when people ask me about making a podcast, and a podcast is not nearly the amount of work that making a video series is, but people ask me about it, I'm like, you have to know this is a huge commitment and you have to keep putting out content and here's everything you need to buy it. And it's like, it's not, I'm not trying to be a buzzkill, but there are some technical and, you know, practical things you have to think about before the fun of making your own show.
Yeah. I mean, it is time consuming, but I feel like anything worth doing is, I don't know that this is necessarily something that I'll look back on with pride and tell my children, like, yes, children, your father wrote and talked about every single Game Boy game. But, you know, I would like for the work that I'm doing, at least the website that I'm building around it, to be a resource for people so they can look and see, you know, basic information about every game and hopefully something more substantial for a lot of them. And, you know, some of that information already exists. But for Game Boy, at least, because it's a less popular system and something that people have not really tackled in this degree of detail before, I hope that it's something that, you know, at least adds a little something to the breadth of video game history available out there.
I can see that. I see the value in owning your own work, because I know it's going to happen again, but twice in my life, like months and months, and in some cases years and years of work have just been destroyed from the internet because the owners of that content did not want to keep them up. And I have several things at Joystick, and Joystick just went down, and I don't know if that content's going to be around. So I'm like, God, do I have to back up all this stuff too? So it has to be nice to be like, this is content that's mine. I feel the same way about our podcast too. Like, this is something I own. No one can take it from me, and we can put it up where we want. And, you know, this is ours. So I know the pride in that.
Yeah. And part of the Game Boy World project is going beyond video and creating the website to go with it, with a complimentary, but not verbatim article that's, you know, talks about it, a photo gallery of what the game looked like. Yeah, so I'm creating the website and, you know, trying to source as many of the original games with their contents as possible to get photographs and have this, you know, the photo gallery available. And that stuff is easy to compile into a book, you know, not like a book published through a respectable publisher, but, you know, self-published and available for people. So that resource will be available. I think, you know, if I can figure it out, maybe I'll compile some of the videos onto a DVD or something. So that will also exist in a physical form and be available for people to look at. There's probably like 20 or 30 people in the world that actually care. But for those 20 or 30 people, that resource will be available. It's definitely catering to a niche audience. But that's okay, because that's what the internet is really for, is you know, the sort of future of highly specific channels of content and information. And so I'm happy to have my little nook that I can burrow into.
You think we've kind of reached like oversaturation when it comes to things like video game videos at this point? I mean, there's so many people are doing them. I mean, at some point, is the world going to burn out when it comes to watching videos about video games on YouTube?
I guess, but at the same time, like, I have discovered in researching for, you know, articles and videos for Game Boy World, there's not a lot of information about a lot of these games out there. Like, sometimes I'll find that, you know, Cygnus Destroyer or someone on YouTube has done a video about a game, but it's not comprehensive. I mean, maybe the video itself is, but, like, the coverage of the different games, like, the number of games being covered, like, there is no all-encompassing resource for these games. And I think, you know, as long as there is still information out there to be gleaned, that's great. I mean, even something like the NES, I think people are constantly learning new information about who made the games. And again, this is all very niche, but I think for the history, or, you know, for the medium to really mature, it needs its history chronologized, if that's a word, as much as possible.
You have a point. Like, before we had our Neo Geo Pocket Color WonderSwan podcast, like, I was like, okay, I need to see some WonderSwan games in action. I've never seen them. And the only resource I found was your video you made for US Gamer, for the most part.
Yeah, and like, the guy who put that video together, I don't know where he found the material. Like,
God. Maybe Nico.
I admire the fact that he managed to source all that stuff. But yeah, like, there's all kinds of video game systems that just aren't covered in depth. And, you know, maybe, again, only a handful of people are ever going to care. But I personally want that information to be out there. I want that that archive of knowledge to be preserved.
Yeah, the woman, I forget her name. I think her name is Rachel. She was on our show. She does the stuff with the Loopy system, and she's like the only person writing about that for the most part, or at least making people aware of it again.
What was the Loopy system again?
It was a system designed for girls in Japan. Oh, and it was
by Casio, right?
I think so, yeah. And all the games are very, like, very feminine. Like, you know, we have an entire episode on, so please check that out. It's called Girl Games, I think we called it. But it was very much a female-focused system.
I'm thinking, you know, I think a good idea for Bob, he should start working on, like, a Kron iPhone game series.
Oh, my God.
That's one niche that has not yet been touched, and there's probably a lot of gems out there.
I think if I was going in chronological order, I would probably kill myself by the time I hit all the Flappy Bird clones. Just, like, 17 episodes of Flappy Bird clones.
There are how many tens of thousands of games are on iPhone at this point?
I don't know. How many of them are actually different games, though?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. This is my Endless Runner game. It's way different than all those other ones.
Yeah, probably. When you think about it, I mean, stuff like the iPhone, a lot of that stuff is probably just going to disappear from human memory completely. I'm sure a lot of it already has.
Yeah, I mean, like, what's going to happen when something is unplayable on an older iPhone? Will anyone care? Will there be emulators? I don't know.
Well, as Frank Spaldi mentioned, one of the games that his company was an Xbox 360 like arcade game that is no longer available. It's only a few years old.
Yeah, I mean, already there have been a bunch of digital only games on Xbox 360, PlayStation 3 that have been delisted for various reasons. Like, you know, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles arcade game remake, you can't buy that anymore. And because it was never released in the physical form, like, how do you get that? How do you play that?
Yeah, there's this weird trade-off between convenience and reservation. The fact that stuff like the new PlayStation streaming thing, for example, how will those, when games sort of, if they ever switch to, like, all streaming, will those things sort of disappear forever, kind of like the Stellaview or something like that?
I'm really worried that, in terms of the streaming service, that they won't offer the games I want to play. Because if you look at the games that sell on PSN, the classic games, it's like Crash Bandicoot 1, Crash Bandicoot 2, Crash Bandicoot 3, Crash Bandicoot Racing.
What do you have against Crash Bandicoot?
I can get those games easily. I can't get, like, I don't know, like, Vagrant Story as easily, to name something. Just something rarer, you know, something that is not as obvious as a Crash Bandicoot. Suikoden 2, there you go, that's a better one.
Is that one available in any kind of, like, PlayStation Store?
Suikoden 2?
Yeah.
Yeah, it just came out in December after, like, years and years of waiting, and it's like, they charged, like, $3 more, but whatever. It was, like, so expensive to buy it, you know, in physical form.
Yeah, that's just one of those games that people just love to bits. It was kind of like, I guess some years ago, they finally released the Rondo of Blood.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
After years and years and years of people wanting that thing.
Yeah, they didn't just release it once, but twice. They put it on the PlayStation Portable remake as a ROM, and then also on Virtual Console.
We're still waiting for Mother 3, right?
That's correct.
Yes. I'm skeptical. But Nintendo is so desperate now, it just might happen. I mean, they released Earthbound, and I think a less desperate Nintendo would not have done that.
So we've been kind of all over the place with this episode.
I like it.
Talking kind of about the topic, but also kind of not about the topic. Are there any final thoughts before we call it a day?
I guess just everyone out there, I mean, just, you know, think about doing your own Quantum Gaming project. It's fun. It's easy.
I'm lying.
But yeah, Ballman, I definitely would like to see more people out there sort of doing some work.
I don't make videos. I should make more videos, but I like what Jeremy and Dr. Sparkle do. And I will continue to watch the videos as I fall asleep every night. Not really. I also watch your videos during the day, during daytime hours. And I can't wait for the next front end. I won't bother you about it because I know you probably get a lot of people bothering you about it.
We're working on Kron Sega right now. And people actually get angry almost. You know, I have some kind of spicy comments occasionally.
Oh,
people, you know, it happens. People are impatient.
I think I would read that as they like me so much that they're mad.
There you go.
Yeah.
As for myself, I don't regret what I have done. No regrets.
I regret nothing.
Like I said, I'll be dabbling in some N64 games soon. Because why not? It's a poorly served corner of video game history as well.
I like to announce that I'm going to be working on Kron Virtual Boy, which is an achievable feat, I think. Wait, is that 8 games or something?
No, it's like 40.
40 games?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind that. I'm out.
Were there really that many?
Yeah, believe it or not, there were quite a few games.
Wow. Okay, that's too much for me.
A bunch of them didn't make it to the U.S., though. And some of them are very, very expensive.
I bet. Yeah, I'm not doing that.
All right.
Sorry to let you down, everyone.
Well, anyway, let's call it a day. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Dr. Sparkle, for making the trip down here. I guess we do the sign-off thing now where we talk about who we are. We are Retronauts. You can find us at retronauts.com, at usgamer.net. We're on Twitter. We're on Twitch. We're on YouTube. We're on Tumblr, et cetera, et cetera, as Retronauts. I personally am Jeremy Parrish. You can find me at usgamer or on Twitter as GameSpite.
This is Dr. Sparkle, a.k.a. Quantendo. There's the Twitter, the Tumblr, the blog, the YouTube. Probably the only thing that'll come up when you search for Quantendo is me. So that's how you find me.
And you can find me, Bob Mackey, on Twitter as Bob Servo. I'm also writing for US Gamer. I'm their senior editor. Check out my work there. And I'm also writing for Something Awful. I write every few weeks there. So check out my articles there. There's a lot of them.
All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back next week with a micro and the week after with a full episode. So please enjoy. And also, don't forget, you can give us money at Patreon so we can keep making money. So we can keep making episodes. Also money. I don't know. Whatever. It's great. Have fun. Thanks for supporting us and listening. Bye.